Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 129 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center, where I'm also serving as interim chair and always looking for new faculty in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
Also with us is the pimping bell. We've got a couple of them, one for each of us, so we don't miss ringing them. When the pimping bell rings, it means we're asking an especially question-worthy content. So pay attention, and maybe it's something you'll want to ask your residents if you're in an academic program or residents. Maybe it's something that somebody will ask you. Our mission here on Dermasphere is to bring you discussions of some of the latest research in the world of clinical dermatology, so you don't have to spend so much time flipping through articles, etc. Couple announcements before we begin. Michelle, both you and I have a CME program running through the Gathered platform. I think that's how it's supposed to be pronounced, GATHER-ED. Mm-hmm. And this is a longitudinal free experience where you collaborate with each other. There's a couple live conversations. So I believe, Michelle, yours is on prurigo nodularis.
Correct.
And mine is on chronic spontaneous urticaria. Again, it's free. Anybody is welcome to join us, and we'll try to remember to put a link in the show notes if you would like to do so. All right, and now for our main topics today, I'm going to start here with a discussion about melanoma in congenital melanocytic nevi. The title of the article is Melanoma in Congenital Melanocytic Nevi. Though nevi is spelled N-A-E-V-I because this is out of the British Journal of Dermatology.
Very British.
The chief authors are Veronica Kinsler and Dr. Slater there out of London, the Great Ormond Street Hospital. I am a big fan of Veronica Kinsler's work. We have discussed it in a few other episodes. For example, in episode 70, we discussed one of her group's articles that came out in 2015 about the congenital melanocytic nevus syndrome, suggesting that if patients have two congenital nevi that were present at birth of any size, then they should get an MRI in order to evaluate for CNS abnormalities. So she's really the, I would say, leading expert on congenital melanocytic nevi around the world today. By the way, that previous article found NRAS mutations in 80% of these congenital nevi, so that seems significant. So this particular article is a review of both benign and malignant proliferations in congenital nevi. So if you have a patient who has, you know, especially the big ones, medium to large to giant congenital melanocytic nevi, you want to pay attention to this kind of stuff. As a reminder, a somewhat arbitrary size cutoff. This is certainly for the residents out there. So the size of the nevi are their projected adult size. And there's actually ways to try to calculate it, but you can just kind of guess. If it's 1.3 centimeters now, it's very likely to be over 1.5 centimeters by the time the child is an adult, etc. So if it's 0 to 1.5 centimeters, it is small. If it is 1.5 to 20 centimeters in dimension, in a particular dimension, then it's medium. That's a pretty big range. If it's 20 or more, it's large. And then some people say 40 or more is giant. That takes up, 40% of somebody's body at that point, for example. So these congenital nevi can have benign proliferations, which can sometimes be a bit difficult to try to sort out from the malignant ones. But the authors here divide the benign proliferation into two different categories, proliferative nodules and neuroid overgrowth. They call the proliferative nodules classic proliferative nodules as well. These have a well-defined edge, a round or oval outline, and a smooth and sometimes shiny surface. They can be soft, they can be firm, but they're not hard. If something's hard, you might start worrying about malignancy. They're smallish, usually half a centimeter to 2 centimeters, but they can be up to 5 centimeters. They can be any color, but they're mostly pink or less darkly pigmented than the surrounding nevus. They're often congenital, but they can appear anytime in childhood, and they grow over a period of weeks and then stabilize. So that's kind of scary, right? Mm-hmm. A new discolored bump that's growing in a congenital nevus, like, you want to worry about that. But oftentimes they end up being these proliferative nodules. And then there's histopathology as well, which I'm not an expert on, but I know somebody who is. But they point out that the histopathology of these proliferative nodules is a mixture of morphological cell types with a pushing border that distorts the surrounding structures. In contrast to melanoma, there's no necrosis, cytological atypia, or increased proliferative activity. And then the other type of benign growth they mention is called neuroid overgrowth. These are like big areas. They have poorly defined edges. They're round, they're ovoid, or they could be fusiform, which I think sort of means like a...
It's like a spindle shape.
They're usually fairly big, several centimeters to even over 20 centimeters, generally less pigmented than the surrounding nevus again. They're usually pink to red. They're more soft or lipoma-like, and they can become kind of pendulous because they're soft. Usually not there at birth, but they develop in childhood, and they grow slowly over the years. They're often on the flanks or buttocks. Histopathologically, they have a neuroid differentiation, which shows nodules of bland spindle cells. Again, a spindle. Within a variably myxoid stroma without significant atypia. They have not been reported to have transformed into melanoma.
You said myxoid stroma with an Irish accent for some reason. With a variably myxoid stroma. It was really cute.
Well, I assume that's how you dermatopathologists always say myxoid
stroma. I mean, you're right. Stroma is very, you have to roll the R or else you're not saying it right.
So you got to look out for the benign proliferations. Of course, if you've got any concerns, a biopsy is never a bad idea. In terms of true melanoma, okay, so this is their cohort of 448 patients who had congenital nevi, and if you took them all together, 2% of them had melanoma. Giant congenital melanocytic nevi that also had smaller lesions, which used to be called satellite lesions, but now we try not to do that, they had the largest risk. So 8% of those patients had melanoma versus 1% of the patients who did not have these giant congenital nevi. The strongest risk factor for melanoma in either the skin or the CNS was an abnormal screening MRI of the CNS within the first months of life. And in this group, the incidence was 12%. CNS melanoma in these patients is at least as common as cutaneous melanoma. So you got to pay attention to their neurologic signs and symptoms. And they say this is another reason to perform early CNS MRI in patients with two or more congenital melanocytic nevi. As I mentioned earlier, this group still recommends MRI within the first 6 months of life. Though they do note that they perform the procedure at their institution without anesthesia. They perform the feed and wrap technique, I believe. Mm-hmm. And again, they said two or more congenital nevi of any size. And so when that came out, a lot of pediatric dermatologists were like, really? Like two of them that are each 3 millimeters? I got to perform a CNS MRI. So there was a potential update to this knowledge in 2022, which we discussed in episode 93. Woo-hoo. It was a different group that says you need to worry only if at least one of the nevi is medium-sized or larger. So I think that aligns more with our expectations and our experience. But I do believe it. If a patient has two or more nevi at birth, one is medium or larger, you should do a CNS MRI, hopefully within the first 6 months of life. If the MRI demonstrates the relatively common finding of intraparenchymal melanosis, imaging does not require repeating routinely, but the author suggests that the patient gets annual neurodevelopmental monitoring until school age because there's an increased incidence of neurodevelopmental problems and seizures in the patients with intraparenchymal melanosis. If your patient does get a melanoma on the skin, then it usually presents as a new nodule or lump. So it's sort of in the deep dermis or subcutis. So I often tell parents, sometimes you just want to like intentionally rub your hand over the nevus and let us know if you get any lumps or bumps in there that weren't there before. And of course, if a patient develops CNS melanoma, then they get focal neurological symptoms, which we may or may not recognize because we ain't neurologists, but seizures is a possibility, signs and symptoms of increased intracranial pressure, headaches and photophobia and nausea, vomiting type stuff. So maybe how we think about pseudotumor cerebri with our isotretinoin patients. These authors recommend if a patient has these symptoms, you should get an MRI if the symptoms persist for 2 weeks or more. They say routine monitoring, so having them like come in for neurologic evaluation every X amount of time, or come in even for skin monitoring X amount of time, is unnecessary. So you don't necessarily, according to this group, need to bring your patients with giant nevi back every year or every some amount of time to keep looking at them. But the parents should know warning signs of both cutaneous and CNS melanoma. They also say, routine surgical excision of congenital melanocytic nevi is not part of our management, as there is no evidence that it alters melanoma risk. And I think that aligns with a lot of other pediatric dermatologists, too. We tend to shy away from recommending surgical excision for these lesions, but we're not plastic surgeons, so maybe other specialties have different ideas. So overall, I found this article is pretty reassuring. And it helps delineate your high risk from your low risk patients. If you do have a patient with giant congenital melanocytic nevi, they almost always have like these satellite lesions as well. So they are at higher risk and they should hopefully have received an early CNS MRI, which can help you stratify them further. And if they don't have those things, then the risk is really low, like 1% or less probably for sort of the average congenital melanocytic nevus.
Yeah. I think managing kids with congenital melanocytic nevus syndrome is so difficult because each one of those children's presentation is so unique. So I think that having some guidelines around that's really helpful.
Yes. Yeah, so thanks, Great Ormond Street Hospital. I look forward to all of the work that you do.
All right. Well, in an adjacent topic, we're going to have part two of the dysplastic. So we're going to talk about the dysplastic nevus, part two of the molecular genetic profiles and management. So we talked about the genetic profiles last episode, in episode 128. Now here in episode 129, we're going to talk about management. The first management piece we're going to talk about is the use of the pigmented lesion assay. So this is a non-invasive molecular and genetic test to help enhance diagnosis and distinguish nevi from melanomas using an adhesive patch. So this is the tape stripping test.
Wait, this is a particular test that's produced by a particular company. We're talking about this specific test.
Yes, produced by a particular company. Right? This is the DermTech sticker, yes.
We're not funded or anything by these guys, by the way.
We are not related to these people. I've done research with Castle about squamous cell carcinoma by submitting squamous cell carcinoma samples, but nothing related to this test. So the pigmented lesion assay is supposed to help distinguish nevi from melanomas. Originally, it was a two-gene PLA test, and that was looking for overexpression of Link and PRAME. So Link is not just the character from Legends of Zelda, Luke. Link is also something called long non-coding RNA. This is highly expressed in many different kinds of cancer. And with melanoma, it's known to promote metastasis of cutaneous melanoma through an unclear mechanism. The PRAME is the preferentially expressed antigen in melanoma. So it's a little bit of machinations around how you actually get the name PRAME out of that. So you get the PR from preferentially. Expressed is just out the window. You don't say anything about expressed. Antigen with the A, and then melanoma for the ME is for PRAME. So this is tumor-associated antigen. It was very interesting how they identified this. They identified it through tumor-reactive T-cell clones from a patient that had metastatic cutaneous melanoma. So a specific patient was the source of the development of the PRAME antigen. I think that was sometime in the late 90s. PRAME is expressed in cutaneous melanoma, ocular melanoma, and some nevomelanocytic malignant neoplasms, including non-small cell lung cancer, breast cancer, renal cell carcinoma, ovarian carcinoma, and certain kinds of leukemia. So that is what PRAME is. So Link and PRAME were the first two constituents of the PLA test. Then after that, they added TERT. And if you remember, we discussed TERT a little bit in the first part of the discussion of this article, where TERT stands for telomerase reverse transcriptase and is the catalytic subunit of telomerase that is supposed to complex with TERC, which is telomerase RNA component. And remember that TERT promoter mutations are the most frequent non-coding mutation in cancer. So when they added the TERT gene assessment to the PLA test, it improved the specificity of that test. They found that in the development of this assay, that NRAS and non-V600E BRAF mutations were not as helpful in making the distinguishment between melanoma and nevus as TERT was. So if they had overexpression of Link or PRAME in lesions that were suspected to be melanoma, and then they also had TERT promoter mutations, that was a much higher correlation. So 28 out of 30 melanomas had Link or PRAME or both overexpression in this assay. TERT promoter mutations were found in 22 out of 30 melanomas. The NRAS and non-V600E BRAF mutations were only found in 3 and 2 of the 30 melanomas respectively. And so they settled on TERT as the 3-gene element for the PLA, for the pigmented lesion assay. And so there have been some studies here that have found similar results in histologically dysplastic nevi and non-dysplastic nevi with expression of LINC and PRAME by themselves. TERT does enhance the specificity of that test. It is still a test that's finding its place in our utilization. And many of us that are pigmented lesions focused in our practice use it sometimes, but not uniformly. So I know that the company would like us to use it every time we have a question about, you know, is this lesion malignant or not? I don't think that that's really what the utility of the test is for. I think it's for those circumstances where biopsy is complicated or challenging, if you really need to have a little bit more support for the diagnostic treatment plan. The other things to remember about the PLA is it's not validated in children and it's not validated for acral lesions. So some of those places where we would like to use this test, we are not really supposed to be using that test yet. So that is how you use the PLA lesion. Management of the congenital acquired nevi. The total body photography, dermoscopy, and digital dermoscopic monitoring can help in the assessment of common acquired nevi and any kind of lesion, of course, that is changing, symptomatic, or atypical appearing can be either assessed clinically and then determination made about whether or not to biopsy it versus following it longitudinally. I do use digital dermoscopy to do sort of sequential monitoring of lesions that are borderline, because generally melanocytic lesions that are malignant will change over a period of 3 months, whereas something that's just a funny looking acquired nevus that's actually benign is not going to change significantly over that period of time. The fact that also only 20 to 30% of melanomas arise in pre-existing nevi and the malignant transformation of an individual nevus being at a very low rate of 0.00005% to 0.003% per year, so very, very low transformation rate, that kind of allows for some comfort with the sort of sequential monitoring of lesions that are borderline. So key points.
Mm-hmm. Can you translate that into a 1 in 1,000? Is it? I've heard 1 in 17,000 chance for a random mole to turn into melanoma. I think I've heard 1 in 30,000.
I would have to do some algebra quickly to get to that. But perhaps you could do that while I talk about the next part.
What is it again? Point what?
So 0.00005%. So 4 zeros and a 5, and that's the bottom of the range. The top of the range is 0.00, so 2 zeros and a 3. So if you want to do that while I discuss the next point. So management of histologically dysplastic nevi can be complicated and varies regionally and by dermatopathologist. If you are in an area where there's greater consensus, there can be more uniformity to that. Some large pathology groups have specific policies for recommendations about re-excisions and how they report on a dysplastic nevus. And negative histopathologic margins do need to be interpreted with a grain of salt. So I think most people know that we as dermatopathologists, when we're looking at a specimen because of how they are processed, are basically looking at only 2% of the true margin of the specimen. This is why Mohs is such a powerful technology, because Mohs does that on FOSS processing of the true tissue margin, and you can assess 100% of the true tissue margin instead of the 2% you get with routine histology. This is one of the reasons why we have set ranges of re-excision margin for different kinds of neoplasms, because over time, we've developed guidelines based off of past performance that have informed those decisions and help us to ensure that the negative histologic margin that we see on that 2% of the specimen can really, in actuality, translate to decreased risk for the patient. When you're talking about shave or punch biopsies of dysplastic nevi, they have done some good studies to look into how often are we right about this, that it's really actually clear? And when does it actually matter? So the consensus is that any kind of dysplastic nevus that is mild or moderately dysplastic and has a negative margin can just be observed. So long as the intention was to remove the lesion, the margins are reported back as negative, and it is mild or moderate dysplasia, generally re-excision of those lesions is unnecessary. There's increasing evidence that nevi that are moderately dysplastic with histologic dysplasia that have positive margins on a punch, shave, or excisional biopsy doesn't need re-excision either if the biopsy was done with the intention of removing the entire lesion. Now, there are some risks that you take on with that management step. One of the biggest ones is the fact that if you do have persistence of a melanocytic lesion, especially a dysplastic one, it can grow back. It can grow back as something that we call pseudo melanoma because it looks kind of a lot like melanoma, clinically and histopathologically. There are certain guardrails that help us to be more comfortable around the space of a recurrent nevus. Some of them include that the changes of pigmentation don't extend beyond the margins of the scar, and histopathologically, that the areas of atypia are confined to the areas over the scar, because what we call pseudomelanoma or recurrent persistent nevus phenomenon presents frequently with a proliferation of lentiginous melanocytes at the dermal epidermal junction that are frequently hyperpigmented because they're reacting to the growth signals that the body used to heal the wound. So they look terrifying sometimes when they recur. They aren't, but they look terrifying. One of the risks you take on by leaving something that has positive histologic margins that was dysplastic is that if it recurs and it is biopsied by somebody who either doesn't know that that can be a recurrent nevus or doesn't take the time to inform their pathologist that they think this is a recurrent nevus, may then send that to a pathologist who is not as familiar or versed in recurrent or persistent nevus phenomenon, and that lesion may get overinterpreted as a melanoma, and that can create harm for both you and for the patient. So whenever I do make the decision not to re-excise a dysplastic nevus with moderate cytologic atypia and positive margins, I have a discussion with the patient where I tell them, if anybody ever decides that they need to biopsy this lesion again, which is okay if somebody does, they need to make 100% sure that the pathologist that they're sending the specimen to knows that this was biopsied before, and that that person is fully qualified to interpret complicated melanocytic biopsies, that they're a dermatopathologist with good training. Because in some areas, general pathologists are also reading melanocytic lesions, and there can be significant risk for overdiagnosis in that setting. You also do risk, as a pathologist, underestimating if something is a partial biopsy. So if you're, you know, sending physicians are really good about telling you this is a 5x6 millimeter lesion and your gross description is that this is a 7x7x1 specimen and it's not positive anywhere at the edges or it just barely reaches one margin or something, you can be comfortable that this is probably not a sampling biopsy. But as a pathologist, I have had the experience of a sending dermatologist biopsying part of one lesion and sending it to one pathology group and biopsying the other part of the same lesion and sending it to another pathology group with no clinical information. So you do open yourself to risk without that good clinical correlation and communication. So when you're talking about margin positive dysplastic nevi with moderate cytologic atypia, clinical pathologic correlation is essential.
Wait, were they just trying to figure out who they liked better?
This person had a very strange personality and kind of liked to pit people against each other as in tests of skill and feats of strength. That person, I think, has now retired. But it was just, you know, you don't know the personalities of people that are sending to you unless you know the personalities of people that are sending to you. And so you do have to make sure you have good correlation and a good expectation that you're actually looking at the entire lesion and not a partial biopsy, because partial biopsies do carry significant risk of missing melanoma associated with a dysplastic nevus. The other piece of risk you take on is that patients who have especially multiple dysplastic nevi, histologically dysplastic nevi, are at higher risk for melanoma development at a separate site. And so these patients' lifetime melanoma risk is higher than somebody from the general populace. So you can definitely monitor those patients carefully. You can definitely counsel those patients appropriately. There isn't strong evidence that melanomas are more likely to develop within the dysplastic nevi than the normal appearing skin in patients with dysplastic nevus syndrome or in patients who just have common melanocytic nevi, but there is sort of that potential risk. The kind of concept of pre-melanoma that we discussed in the previous podcast is one that we don't really want to encourage because we don't want people to be ritualistically demoled, and we know that removing all of a person's nevi does not eliminate their risk for development of melanoma as it can arise in normal appearing skin. So you don't want to do over-treatment for patients, especially for milder, less severely atypical nevi. Now, when you talk about severely dysplastic nevi, most people will agree, most pathologists will agree, that a complete re-excision is important with those. Not necessarily because severely dysplastic nevi are all going to turn into melanoma, but because there is significant overlap in the histological features of a severely dysplastic nevus and a melanoma, and the potential for misdiagnosis exists. And so when you have a patient that has a severely dysplastic nevus, you do want to make sure that you got all of that lesion completely removed. And that's just because of there's still some uncertainty as to where the line is with severe dysplasia versus melanoma. The other interesting question is, do you report margins on a shave or punch biopsy? And not all pathologists will do this. I've found in my practice as a dermatopathologist that it really is the preference of the sending physician whether you interpret those margins or not for them. However, when it is on a punch or a shave biopsy, I do have an auto text that says less than 2% of the true tissue margin is examined in a shave or punch biopsy specimen to make sure that the patient, that the clinician is aware that we don't have certainty that the margin is clear. When you look at consensus agreements for people about what we should do with this middle category, because there's pretty good confidence that mildly dysplastic nevi, even present at the margin, leave them alone. Severely dysplastic nevi with narrow, clear, or involved margins should be re-excised. But what do we do with these moderate lesions that are present at the margin? You add more doubt to the question when you realize that when we look at series of dysplastic nevi that had a negative punch or shave biopsy margin, depending on the study, 30 to 20% of those will have positive margins on deeper sectioning. And so we're not really that precise with margin determination for shave or punch biopsy specimens. So if you have concern about the biologic potential of a lesion, it would be more appropriate in that setting to re-excise because you have up to like a 30% chance of not being correct by that. There's a lot of studies that the authors go over about the number of melanomas that develop in patients who had dysplastic nevi with moderate or severe atypia left in place and then monitored. The uniformly reassuring thing is that the rates of melanoma development at the site of the previous biopsy are very, very small. Some of them 0.44%, 0.39%. There was a study that looked only at severely histologically dysplastic nevi that were followed for up to 12 years and only two patients, which was 1%, were diagnosed with melanoma on re-excision. So fairly low numbers of patients, but not zero. And so we all have to sort of mitigate risk for the patient and for ourselves on an individual basis. And I actually have these discussions with the patients. You know, I tell them, patients like you that have lots of moles, and some of them are sort of funny looking, we call that dysplastic nevus syndrome. And when a person has dysplastic nevus syndrome, they have a higher risk of making melanoma in the skin. Sometimes the melanoma is found after it's metastasized, and we don't always know where it came from. So if you're a person who would feel more comfortable being certain that everything is removed, let's go ahead and do that for you so you don't have that sort of Damocles hanging over your head. If you're more worried about the re-excision and the scar than you are about the very small but not zero risk that something might come back from this, then we can monitor you carefully and follow you over time. And I think that so long as you're giving patients informed decision-making capacity, then you're doing kind of the right kind of care for each patient, because the numbers are relatively small in terms of how many patients will actually develop melanoma out of these dysplastic nevi, even when there's moderate to severe dysplasia. So personally, I think re-excision of severely histologically dysplastic nevi with a positive margin is a no-brainer. Those should be re-excised. There is not a coherent guideline for which margins we should use to re-excise these. They range usually between 2 and 5 millimeters. What do you usually do, Luke?
I'm more in the 5 range.
Mm-hmm. And I think that if the pathologist was worried enough to call it severely dysplastic, and because we know that there's histologic overlap between early melanoma and severely dysplastic nevi, I think 5 millimeters, if possible, is very reasonable and appropriate to do. And I think that the management of those moderately dysplastic melanocytic lesions is more appropriate to just have that really, you know, specific discussion with the patients about. The take-home points from this article, the TLDR version, patients with histologically dysplastic nevi have an increased risk of melanoma. They need to be surveilled more regularly than your patients who do not have that syndrome for the development of melanoma. Please, please, please try to remove all of a melanocytic lesion when you have to take it. In this report, the patients who developed melanoma at the site of the previously biopsied severely dysplastic melanoma all had subtotal biopsies. So we have a sampling error potential there. And as we saw in the first part of this article, where they really margin out where the dysplasia is occurring in the lesion, these lesions could be quite heterogeneous. And so the part that you choose to biopsy might not be the part that's developed into melanoma, and you may be giving the patient a false sense of security. So whenever possible, removing the entire lesion at once for interpretation in its totality is preferred. And then there's also, for the residents or anybody who's learning dermoscopy, a fantastic table here on page 17 of this article, which is detailing some of the dermoscopic features of melanoma, both in sun-damaged skin and in non-sun-damaged skin, with really good sort of figure depictions of the different features that you might look for. So I think that while we are still evolving our understanding of how to manage these lesions, the most important take-home points from this article are that mutations happen over time with melanocytic lesions. The more clinically atypical something is, the more histologically atypical it tends to be. The more histologically atypical something tends to be, the more abnormal genetics it tends to have. And we have an increase over time of those genetic mutations with UV radiation. So our patients can mitigate their risk with sun protection and regular skin exams. And if you are going to biopsy a lesion, just get the whole thing.
All right. That was some intense dysplastic nevus conversation. I hope you're not done with intense conversations, because this next one is a doozy. It's from the journal Cell and is called Staph aureus drives itch and scratch-induced skin damage through a V8 protease-PAR1 axis. The authors are mostly out of Harvard and the University of Colorado, and they include Liwen Deng, Flavia Costa, Kimbria Blake, and Isaac Chu. One of my patients actually mentioned this article, which was what brought it to my attention. This was back in like November, and we were talking about itch or something, and he said, "Haven't they figured out what causes itch? Isn't it staph?" And I said, "Well, I think there's probably lots of reasons that cause itch. Why do you say that?" And he said, "Oh, there was this article that I've heard about." So I presume that's this one. So the capsule summary here, this is a super dense basic science article that in which the scientists discover that staph bacteria cause itch, specifically through a protein that the bacteria produce called V8 protease. Is that old tomato juice product V8 still around? Or
yeah, definitely. You can still buy V8.
I remember that those TV ads from when I was like a teenager where they said, "Have you had your V8 today?" And everyone was sort of like walking crooked if they hadn't had their V8. Remember those?
Yes, I do remember that.
All right. Well, these staph, it turns out, produce V8. So you really don't want it in this context. Mm-hmm. So this V8 stuff specifically activates a receptor in our neurons, which is called PAR1, PAR1. And then the scientists further discover that blocking or eliminating PAR1 mostly eliminates the itch. So one thing I discovered is that if you hate mice, becoming a researcher that looks into dermatologic issues is a great career choice for you, as it seems like these researchers hated mice. I'm sure they didn't, but they subjected these mice to a lot of things. So again, let's pour one out for our furry brothers and sisters who undergo this stuff to advance our knowledge. So the researchers got some MRSA and they rubbed it on a bunch of mice. And then they did various experiments to see what happened to the mice and why, which led to the conclusions I already mentioned. But here are some of the things they did to and with these mice. The funniest one is that they had assistants watch the mice on infrared camera and document the number of scratching behaviors the mice exhibited over a 90-minute period. This sounds like a terrible job for an assistant. Sit and stare at infrared mice and write down a little tally mark every time they scratch themselves. They also examined the mice's dorsal root ganglia, I presume not while they were still alive. They created versions of mice with missing genes, the knockout technology. They poked them with various filaments. They wrapped them with Tegaderm so they couldn't scratch themselves. They injected them with staph bacteria to compare pain versus itch. They depleted their basophils with antibodies. They treated them intrathecally with small interfering RNAs. And they gave them drugs that inhibited certain peptides. And all of that, they discovered that staph produced this V8 protease specifically. It activated this PAR1 receptor in neurons, and that led to itch. PAR1 is not the only PAR associated with itch, so PAR2 and PAR4, if you're an itch researcher, you may have run into those, because plant proteases tend to induce itch through PAR2 and PAR4. They include some plant proteases we may remember from residency, such as bromelain, It's in pineapples, as I recall. And papayan?
Papain?
Perhaps. What's that one part of?
P-A-I-N?
That's the one.
That's part of pain signaling, isn't it?
Certainly sounds possible. And apparently keratinocytes and some immune cells can express cathepsin S, which can also induce itch through PAR2 and PAR4. Mast cell tryptase also activates PAR1. Remember, that's this one that the staph V8 is also activating.
Mm-hmm.
And keratinocytes produce these proteases called kallikreins, which can cleave PAR2 and drive itch. And also, on top of everything else, staph RAs can induce keratinocytes to express these kallikreins.
And yes, these are plant, so the papain is a plant cysteine protease that can evoke itch. So bromelain, if you remember that one, ficin and papain can function as signaling molecules that activate protease-activated receptors, and they can function in itch or pain.
Are they part of specific plants?
They are, actually. Pineapples is one of them.
That's the one I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Don't remember any others. So I think that's the biggest take home. There's like dense pages that explain all of these things that the mice went through to show that staph produces V8, which activates PAR1 and causes itch. Some other interesting bite-sized pieces that came out of this article. 90% of atopic dermatitis lesions are colonized with staph. And I would say, anecdotally anyway, it's not infrequent that giving a child a 5-day course of cephalexin really seems to be what turns around their atopic dermatitis. Scratching. Why do we scratch when we're itchy? Well, the authors say that perhaps we scratch and that causes a little bit of pain, which overrides the itch signal, and that could be why we bother scratching. Scratching, unfortunately, also causes skin damage and barrier disruption, including beyond the exposure site. So these mice got MRSA rubbed on their backs, they got itchy, they scratched themselves, and they found there was skin damage and barrier disruption even beyond the areas that were rubbed with staph. Trimming the mice's nails reduced the skin damage. So if you have itchy patients, consider encouraging them to trim their nails. Do you remember allokinesis?
Allokinesis. Okay, so allo just means other, kinesis is movement. That's as far as I can get.
They say allokinesis is itch evoked by innocuous mechanical stimuli or touch.
Interesting.
So that's why they poked these mice with some filaments to check to see if that made them itchy when it really shouldn't. It is a form of dysesthesia. It's apparently driven by proprioceptor sensitization or spinal cord changes and is regulated by, of all things, Merkel cells. What?
And double bell salute for Merkel cells right there. Yeah.
By the way, Merkel cell carcinoma, I think the current state of the art is we don't actually know that it comes from these Merkel cells. They just kind of look similar. Is that right, Michelle?
So Merkel cells are just normal resident cells in the epidermis as a mechanoreceptor. They tend to kind of glob up together when they become Merkel cell carcinoma, but we do think they're related to each other. Was that answering your question? I was looking up allokinesis.
Yeah, I think I was actually thinking of maybe Paget's disease or something instead.
Ah.
Anywho, don't get Merkel cell carcinoma. It's no bueno.
Yes, but this
allokinesis thing also seems to be mediated by this V8-PAR1 system. Through all of these experiments, they found also that itch and inflammation can be decoupled. So if you get the certain molecules on board, you can clinically see there is inflammation, but the mice are not scratching themselves. There's a drug on the market that exists called Vorapaxar, something like that. It blocks PAR1. It is approved to reduce the risk of thrombotic cardiovascular events. And they gave it to some of these mice and find that they were much less itchy when they got this drug. It's $400 a month, by the way. I don't know that anybody's using it for itch, but it would be kind of interesting to ask any patients who are taking that medicine how itchy they are and compare them to some kind of control group. There's a quote in here. There is interest in intrathecal injection, so again, that's into the spinal cord, as a method to deliver therapeutic small interfering RNAs to modulate gene expression in neurons. I hadn't realized there was interest in this or that this was even a technology that exists, but apparently there are some people out there that are injecting certain bits of RNA into certain I presume, animals' spinal cords in order to modulate gene expression in neurons.
Goodness.
Perhaps it could eventually be used for human treatment. And a final point is that itch from bacteria could be adaptive either from the perspective of the human or from the bacteria. Mm-hmm. From a human standpoint, this PAR1 stuff could deplete other neuropeptides so that you don't have an even worse sensation. And from the bacteria standpoint, if you're itchy, well, you're more likely to kind of spread the bacteria around, create some skin damage, get the bacteria in there, or spread it to other parts of your body or even to other people. So interesting arms race in evolution in terms of itch. So these scientists are super smart. I feel kind of bad for the mice, but it does look like we learned a lot, and I don't think that this is the only thing that causes itch, despite what my patient apparently thought, but it does seem like we came up with a pretty good idea about why staph can cause itch and even some potential therapeutic options in the future.
Fascinating stuff, my dude. Those poor mice. We're going to talk about some more mouse torture later, unfortunately, potentially, if we get to that one article. But that is, sometimes the scientific process requires some sacrifices. So we will again pour out one for our little fuzzy friends in the world of animals. So we're going to talk now about the battling bugs that aren't there. This is actually coming from the AAD's website, and it's going over sort of expert consensus on how to help take care of that most maddening of chief complaints, delusions of infestation or delusions of parasitosis. And one of the things that I really appreciate, this article is written by Jan Bowers, a contributing writer, and it features the perspectives, expertise, and practice pearls from four practicing dermatologists that help take care of patients who have this very difficult condition. So as we know in dermatology, usually we can see, recognize, diagnose, and make a treatment plan for something that patient is presenting with as we're shaking their hand, right? Because our specialty tends to be quite visible. And when we're treating something that is more product of the patient's mind than of their skin, it can challenge us as physicians. But all of the contributing dermatologists in this article advocate for empathy, as we realize that these patients do suffer. They're tormented by the symptoms of this disease just as much as somebody who has something we recognize and is readily kind of self-explanatory, like psoriasis or atopic dermatitis. Patients are also often going to a dermatologist as sort of their last resort. Usually when they come to see us, they've already been to the emergency room. They've already seen their primary care doctor. They may have seen other dermatologists, and they're kind of hoping that somebody is going to be able to help them solve this mystery of why they are so miserably itchy and uncomfortable.
But they haven't seen a mental health provider.
Yes,
this is what drives me crazy. They say they're willing to do anything except consider the idea that this could be a mental health issue.
It's like a bad Meatloaf song, like, I would do anything to not itch except see a psychiatrist.
How dare you call that a bad Meatloaf song?
That is not a bad Meatloaf song. Though the original is not. My lyrics, though, leave something to be desired because I just came up with them on the spot. So they were not very artful, but they get the point across. So we do need to be literate in taking care of psychocutaneous disease as dermatologists. In some studies, up to 30% of patients presenting to an outpatient dermatology clinic will have some kind of psychiatric distress that they're experiencing. The, I think, most difficult one of these to treat is delusional infestation or delusions of parasitosis. It is the most common monosymptomatic hypochondriacal psychosis in dermatology. Common monosymptomatic hypochondriacal psychosis. That didn't work. So DI patients do have a false fixed belief that they are infested with parasites or have foreign objects extruding from their skin. Specifically, Morgellons disease has that belief of foreign objects extruding from the skin. And often patients will perceive that they have protruding fibers or threads. And some people will consider Morgellons as a subset of DI rather than a separate disorder, but they're both very difficult to treat. The DSM-5 classifies delusions of infestation as the presence of a delusion for at least 1 month where the criteria for schizophrenia have not been met. And I think many of us have cared for patients who have delusions of parasitosis with their schizophrenia. And the article points out that in an ideal world, dermatologists would not be in charge of that patient's medical regimen for their mental health disease. But sometimes dermatologists are the only kind of doctors these patients will go to. The patient in general is functioning outside of the delusion of parasitosis. Most episodes have been brief relative to the duration of the delusional period. The disturbance is not attributable to medical conditions, substances, or another disorder. So that's the DSM-5 definition of delusions of parasitosis or delusional infestation. Now, I find that a significant preponderance of my patients who present for concerns about delusions of parasitosis are on some kind of centrally active psychoactive medication, often some kind of stimulant. And in fact, there are practicing neuropsychiatrists that have documented that at escalating doses of stimulant medications, patients who did not have a pre-existing delusion of parasitosis may develop that. So we know that that is a potential risk of that class of medication. Many of my patients that I care for that have this very difficult, tormentous diagnosis have a history of using some kind of methamphetamine. And there is, I think, some structural fusion that happens when people utilize that particular pathway or overutilize that particular pathway in their brain, where I think it sort of changes a bit the way the brain functions and people have a much harder time explaining symptoms to themselves. And then I also, whenever I'm seeing a patient with delusions of infestation or delusions of parasitosis, talk about something I learned in theater. So longtime listeners of Dermosphere will probably know that Luke and I both have theater backgrounds. And one of the things that you have to deal with in theater is something called the slouch towards narrative, which means that humans like to explain things to themselves in a way that makes sense. And in a theater class, often what they'll do is they'll have a person who's sitting at a table by themselves. And, you know, it might be like an older woman sitting at a table by herself. And the instructor will say, "What do you see?" And people will start to make up stories. "Oh, I see a widow waiting for her child to come visit her because she's lonely." Or, "I see a lady writing out her last will and testament." Or, you know, "I see a lonely woman who is, you know, agoraphobic," whatever. So you tell yourself a story about what you see. The exercise continues until somebody says, "I see a woman sitting at a table by herself," because that's all that you can really tell from the circumstance. But we as humans are built to explain things to ourselves. When we have a symptom like itching that's chronic and persistent and that we can't get rid of, our mind is searching constantly for why is this happening, right? And a uniform experience that most humans have is some kind of insect bite. Insects bite you and they're itchy, right? So it makes sense that our brain might explain a, you know, nociceptive experience, a painful or uncomfortable experience to us through a familiar context of bug bites. And so I try to really lead with that and with empathy when I take care of patients who have delusions of infestation, because I think acknowledging the suffering they're experiencing goes a long way to helping develop rapport. And that's one of the things that Dr. Dirk Elston, who I'm a huge personal fan of, I think he's one of the most lovely humans in the world, let alone in the world of dermatology. But like he puts forward that, you know, one of the first things he says to these patients are, "This has got to be like hell to experience this every day. And, you know, to feel like people don't believe you or think that you're crazy." You know, I think most of us will tell patients, "I believe that you are having these symptoms and that they're affecting the quality of your life and that you would really give almost anything to feel normal." And then we have to kind of work down the pathway of, how do we get this patient's symptoms improved so that they can regain quality of life? And there have been some progress made in the recent past in terms of treating patients who have pruritus that is associated with something else. So a patient who has atopic dermatitis and delusions of parasitosis can benefit significantly from a medication like Dupixent. A patient who has uremic pruritus might benefit from some of the selective opiate inhibitors or agonists. Patients that have metabolic dyscrasias that are causing significant pruritus may benefit from the correction of that or from medications that can blunt the itching response, because really I think that's what drives the delusion of infestation. If you do have patients that have something bigger like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, the overwhelming presentation of the skin complaint may mask that. And so some of the experts, including Dr. Majid, who is in Dell in Austin, recommended screening for things like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. Like, do you hold any other beliefs that other people might think are strange? Or sometimes people who are distressed, like I can see that you are, might hear voices. Do you hear voices? And they might actually be able to let you know that they're experiencing more than just delusions of parasitosis or delusions of infestation. The matchbox sign is discussed in the article. It is, I think, appropriate to look into the specimens that the patient brings, if nothing else, just to inform yourself about what they're collecting. I have had a patient that brought like her baggie of skin bits, and there was an actual cockroach in there. And I was surprised to see that when she gave it to me. And I asked her, you know, I see that there's an insect in there. Do you think that that's one of your bugs? And she said, oh, no, my daughter knew that I was collecting my specimens to take to my doctor to talk about my bugs. And she found a bug, so she put it into the baggie for me. And so I like to discuss that anecdote with other doctors because I think that it highlights the fact that delusions of parasitosis or delusions of infestation affect more than just the patient. Many times patients will isolate themselves from their family because they're fearing their contagion. They don't want to give this curse of an experience to the people that they love the most. And also many of the people have had some friction between themselves and their close family members who are trying to help them as best as possible understand that they really don't have an infestation. A lot of the authors in the article talk about the fact that when you do challenge the delusion, somebody who's a very polite, very kind, very appropriate person can become very, very angry and sometimes quite defiant and might even retaliate against the physician through things like online reviews or even more significant ones. I've personally had threats of violence because I wouldn't confirm the delusion that the patient had an infestation. And she was convinced that I was lying to her to increase her suffering. So it can be very difficult to take care of these patients. But I find that generally, if you lead with empathy and you give them respect and consideration for their human experience, that can really help. Now, on to treatment. So many of the drugs that are most effective to treat this condition are ones we don't have a whole lot of experience as dermatologists actually using. You know, many of these medications are going to be antipsychotic medications that are not something that we really have in our wheelhouse. Of course, the first medication that most of us learned about with delusions of parasitosis is pimazide. And Dr. Q actually points out the fact that one of the reasons he chooses pimazide is because if you Google it, it's not designated as an antipsychotic. And it's one of the only drugs that's therapeutic for delusions of infestation that doesn't bear that designation. So patients are going to look up the medications that you give them. And if they find that it's an antipsychotic and you haven't discussed with them that fact, then they might be less trusting of your care because they're going to feel like you were trying to dupe them or deceive them in some way. The pimazide can be useful. The EKG abnormalities that can occur with pimazide tend to happen at higher doses, and often lower doses are effective for patients who have delusions of parasitosis. Risperidone and aripiprazole are also useful antipsychotics. In Europe, they use risperidone more. Dr. Majid from Dell uses more of aripiprazole because it has fewer anticholinergic effects and causes less weight gain than risperidone can. Dr. Koo and Dr. Elston start with 0.5 milligrams of pimazide or risperidone, and then they can increase the dose by 0.5 milligrams every 2 to 4 weeks. Dr. Koo states that the dose is usually needed to be therapeutic in patients with delusions of infestation is 3 milligrams per day or less. And they continue typically for 3 months past any symptoms because early discontinuation can lead to symptom relapse. And then they also do discuss the kind of delicate topic of, do you drug test these patients? You know, I think that sometimes that can be beneficial. Dr. Koo brought forward an anecdote about the fact that one of the patients that he was treating disclosed that they were smoking cannabis. They drug tested that patient and the Utox came back positive for cocaine. Sometimes some producers, procurers, purveyors of cannabis will add some spice to the mix, and some of that is sometimes cocaine. So there's cocaine-laced cannabis out on the streets, and people may be using substances that they don't know they're using that may be worsening their symptoms. So I think that these patients can be very difficult to take care of. I've had DI patients that have had comorbid dementia. I've had DI patients that have had comorbid complex depression. I've had many DI patients that have had current or former methamphetamine abuse. And the treatment of these patients has to be individualized. Usually they do take more time to treat than a typical dermatology patient. If you can get one of them their life back, it can be really rewarding. I had a patient that was a younger woman I was taking care of at the VA. And like many patients that I see who are female at the VA, she had a history of military sexual trauma. And there's a subset of patients that I treat that have DI that have a history of some sort of contamination event that they weren't under control of. And so sexual assault certainly falls into that category. And so this person's psychological distress over that event happening and that fear of contagion, because she'd been a very careful person. She'd only ever been with her husband. She was terrified she was going to die now of cervical cancer and all these things because of what had happened to her. And then she had this kind of itching developed because she'd had a thyroid storm and things like that. We were able to find the medical cause of her pruritus, but also to give her confidence that she wasn't crazy. Her body was trying to help her make sense of what was happening to it, and that we could potentially manage those symptoms better through addressing the underlying causes than kind of pursuing the avenue of antiparasitic drugs that really weren't going to help that much. So if you can get one of these patients their life back, it's like they're sort of coming back from the dead, because it is a miserable existence. I have patients that haven't seen their loved ones in person for 5 years because they don't want to give them these bugs. I have patients who've lived in their garage away from their family because they're afraid of contaminating the people they love the most. And so I think that empathy is really important when we're taking care of these patients.
Way back in demo episode number one, which you can get as a bonus episode somewhere in our stream, we talked about some advice for specific treatment options. I think Dr. Elston was an author on that article, and they preferred risperidone. Mm-hmm. And that's what I use. I prescribed it 2 or 3 times. I'll have to say my patients tended to sort of be lost to follow-up, so I'm not quite sure how it worked, but I did find that I was convinced by that article that that was a pretty good choice.
Yeah.
We probably don't have enough time to talk about any more articles, so I agree with you that delusions of parasitosis is certainly miserable. Also, some gallows humor. I have a couple patients with delusions of parasitosis that I thought presented in somewhat amusing ways. So I had one where she brought in her baggie of stuff that she was wanted me to look at. So I said, okay, I'll take a look at this under the microscope after done with clinic today, and I'll give you a call if I find anything. And we found a flea. And I was so excited. I called her up and I was like, I got really good news. I found a flea, so I think maybe we can help you out. And she said, oh, no. It couldn't be fleas. It's got to be some other kind of bug living in my skin. Really took the wind out of my sails.
Darn it.
And then I had a patient who told me the story. She thought there were bugs living on her skin, etc. And then she finished with, is this all in my head? Please tell me it's all in my head. And I said, I got great news for you. It's all in your head. She was like, oh my God, thank goodness.
That's awesome.
She must have been at the very early stages, but I appreciated her insight.
Love it.
All right, friends. Thanks for hanging out with us today. Today we learned about congenital melanocytic nevi, and they can have benign growths called proliferative nodules, or this sort of neuroid differentiation approach. And if they are going to develop melanoma, it's pretty uncommon, but more common if you have a giant congenital melanocytic nevus and CNS abnormalities on MRI, and you should get an MRI in these patients within the first 6 months of life. We learned a lot about how to manage dysplastic nevi. I think the most important parts are leave the mild ones alone, excise the severe ones, and the moderate ones are kind of a judgment call. I think you can justify either direction. Mm-hmm. We learned that some researchers hate mice. I'm just kidding, guys. I know you don't actually hate them. It's just kind of funny. But we learned that staph bacteria mediates itch through its V8 protease that cleaves PAR1 in our neurons, and if we block that pathway, then we can abrogate that itch. And we learned that delusions of parasitosis is pretty difficult, but lead with empathy, recognize that these are suffering humans, and consider medicines like pimazide, risperidone, and aripiprazole. Thanks to our institutions, thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast, and thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. Oh, by the way, I looked up the numbers you mentioned about the percentages of random nevi turning into melanoma, and the range is very wide, at least by those percentages listed in the article. It's anywhere from 1 in 333 to 1 in 50,000. So there's probably still research to be done to try to narrow that down. So whatever I had heard before of 1 in 17,000 or 1 in 30,000, at least somewhere in the ballpark. Friends, remember, if you'd like to hang out with us some more, you can find Michelle talking about prurigo nodularis and me talking about chronic spontaneous urticaria in these longitudinal online collaborative CME events called Gathered. Again, free, and you get some CME out of it. We'll put links in the show notes. Thanks to all of the members of Team Dermasphere who keep the podcast moving along behind the scenes. They include Lara Dela Cruz, Jordan Easterling, Austin Callister, Nicole Babkowski, Lior Lavin, and Justin Lyon. Thanks for everything that you guys do. One thing you guys do is maintain our website, which is dermaspherepodcast.com. It has links to all of our episodes, so that might be a good way to find our Delusions of Parasitosis article from our demo episode number one. It also has links to all of the articles that we talked about, and it's a good way to reach out and talk to us. You can also find us on X, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find some of our video content on YouTube and a platform called ViewMedi. Friends, if you feel that this podcast has brought you some value and you would like to return some value to us, we are accepting donations at uofuhealth.org/dermasphere. We also are accepting you hanging out with us virtually, not just on the Gathered platforms, but in our U of U Dermatology Echo sessions, which happen the second Friday of every month over the lunch hour. And finally, if you want to hang out in person, I'm running a symposium here in Salt Lake City, Utah, called Practical Derm. It's intended for primary care providers, but everybody is welcome. We're going to talk about a lot of different dermatology. There's a hands-on suturing and biopsy workshop. It's on May 24th here at the University of Utah. You can just Google Practical Derm University of Utah, and you can find it that way. That is all we have for today, friends. Thanks so much for hanging out with us, and we will see you in 2 weeks.